You're listening to the Manolo Quezon is the Explainer podcast. I am recording this on the 25th of February, 2022, the 36th anniversary of the EDSA Revolution. I'm putting together three pieces here as an audio long read. They're very personal, but they also mark this occasion. Thanks for listening. A Facebook post, February 25, 2016, the 30th anniversary of the EDSA Revolution. So this week has been heavy with memory. Mine involves a simple note in an era before emails and the cell phone. What was evening in Manila was morning in the United States. It began with a classmate running into my room screaming, "He's gone!" Marcos, of course. The whole world, it seemed, was Filipino at that moment. But it was a school day and I was in America, where my father was too, but many miles away in Washington, D.C. During an interval between classes, I received a summons to go to the headmaster's office. The secretary handed me a neatly typed note. "Your father called. He wanted you to know your country is free." Later, he would write to me that in Washington, the Filipino community had a mass of thanksgiving and that, when the Philippine national anthem was played, he wept. He had not cried tears of joy like that, he said, since the Independence Day ceremonies of 1946. To be sure, we love freedom and we choose to uphold it in many ways. My personal experience has taught me this, and sometimes it takes time to make sense of it all. But there must always be a special place of honor for those who put themselves in the line of fire, for something greater than themselves. If a nation is an imagined community, as some say it is, still, they, those who can imagine something that transcends faith, class, race, education, tribe, or language, and are prepared in that moment of maximum peril and instant decision to die, armed only with the boldness of imagination, they are the truly blessed. To be born free, the Longview column in the Philippine Daily Inquirer, February 23, 2004. My father used to say he envied my cousins and me because we were born free Filipinos. To him, it was a marvelous thing, a proud thing. I myself envy those old enough to remember what life was like before martial law. But I envy those born after 1986 the most, to have been born and raised in a free country and have no memories of what it is like to live under a dictatorship is a marvelous thing. One of my earliest memories is of the curfew sirens. Childhood was a constant tug of war between the propaganda of the new society in school, where in grade one we were all obliged to bring home and sell Green Revolution raffle tickets, and listening to my father rant about the same tickets. Every year, the school would embark on an English-speaking campaign, and when I'd brag about the points our homeroom racked up, my father would furiously retort he wasn't interested in raising a member of the Hitler Youth, one of my first lessons in history, because then I had to look up who the Hitler Youth were and found out they used to snitch on their neighbors and parents. Life was all about warnings. Be careful what you say over the telephone, and be just as careful when talking to people you don't know, and all about the precautions the warnings entailed. Television after school was an odd, although in retrospect perhaps fitting, combination of Looney Tunes cartoons and Ronnie Nathaniels singing the praises of the conjugal dictatorship. In school, we were taught that President and Mrs. Marcos had saved the country. At home, I'd hear about people being arrested or under surveillance, and of chief justices holding up the First Lady's umbrella. When I was 8 years old, the interim Batasang Pambansa elections were held. It was the year of the noise barrage, something I didn't quite understand, but which was definitely such a big deal as to be dangerously exciting even to a small boy. I recall a mimeographed manifesto ending up in the hospital room in which I'd be confined for pneumonia, of the grown-ups speaking in excited whispers. And then nothing but year after tiresome year, during which colonels continue to be elected to head PTAs, and something called Light of Fire, which made going to Alimol dangerous and deprived Nonoy Zuniga of one of his legs. Everything changed in 1983. We had just moved to the States in that year, and it was in Washington, D.C., that we heard the news that Ninoy, a man I'd never heard of until then, oddly enough, had been killed. When we'd come home for the summer, I'd voraciously read bound copies of Mr. and Miss and watched Betamax tapes of the Japanese coverage of Ninoy's assassination. There was the Parliament of the Streets, stories of Lorenzo Tañada and Chino Roses being knocked down by water cannon. You heard Forbes Park matrons discussing the best way to distribute sandwiches at rallies, and of communists and businessmen finding common cause against Marcos. I will never forget New Year's Eve when 1985 gave way to 1986. The government had sternly warned people not to explode firecrackers, and yet I cannot recall a night when so many firecrackers were defiantly exploded. It was like being in a war movie, and I remember telling myself, Marcos will lose. We were in the United States when that happened. The day began with a jolt when American classmates rushed into my room yelling, "He's gone!" Marcos had fled. A school assembly was held and the priests offered up a prayer for the Philippines. And afterwards, the school secretary came up to me with a note, "Your father called to say that your country is free again." Afterwards, my father told me he attended the Thanksgiving Mass for the Filipino community, and when the national anthem was played, he was in tears. How the whole world admired us then. Life was not all roses after EDSA. But things were improving. The economy was growing by leaps and bounds, but the growth was cut short by the coup attempt of 1987, and the economy made comatose by the coup of 1989. In our selective memories, we dwell too often on the disappointments since EDSA, and not enough on the military adventurism that really set the country back. Time and again, I tell people younger than myself that they shouldn't focus on the politicians that troop to the EDSA shrine year after year. EDSA was about a nation making a decision, absolving itself of the complicity it had in accepting the dictatorship in the first place. We wouldn't have had a dictatorship if the people hadn't supported it in the beginning, regardless of what the military or the Americans would have liked. Marcos didn't last very long when his people finally rejected him. And the disappointments since EDSA are as much the fault of a public willing to leave things in the hands of the politicians as it was the result of military meddling. But it is the absence of an all-pervasive feeling of fear that we should appreciate the most. We have only felt real fear in recent years when the military, backbone of martial law, tried to impose itself on us, or when politicians tried to use the tactics of the parliaments of the streets and of EDSA in support of their thoroughly selfish interests. In both cases, the fear is, mercifully, short-lived, because the efforts of putschists and politicos always fail, because they only really have the lust for power as their motive force, nothing great enough to make you want to cry tears of joy when your national anthem is sung. Father rejected the Marcos dictatorship. Arab News Newspaper, September 13, 2006. September 23 marks the real anniversary of the imposition of martial law in the Philippines. When the news reached my father, we were in Mexico, preparing to go to Brazil, where he was supposed to assume the post of Philippine ambassador to that country. Upon seeing the news in the Mexican papers, my father promptly called the Department of Foreign Affairs and informed Manuel Collantes that he was declining his appointment as ambassador to Brazil. And then he sat around waiting and hoping for a coup to kick Marcos out. The coup never took place. The new society heaved into place with what seemed to be the tacit consent, if not the outright enthusiasm, of the public. There was nothing left but to go home. And so we went home, My father had decided from day one not to accept the legitimacy of the martial law regime. His opposition manifested, among other things, by his telling my mother not to cut my hair, because he'd heard that the Metrocom was going around shaving the heads of hippies, which resulted in my having that long-haired mop-head look in all my pictures that date to 1973. Soon after their return, my father left my mother, and the consequences of that decision affected the way he chose to show his displeasure with the dictatorship. My father's sister, who had no less than 9 children, had also decided not to recognize the legitimacy of Marcos's new society, and as the martial law era dragged on, she became increasingly involved in public protests and in visiting political prisoners. My father reasoned that she could take the risk because she had a husband around who, if worse came to the worst, could look after his sister's children, but he could not afford to take a similar risk. And yet, the question of my safety needed to be balanced with what he thought was the need to show, somehow, a principled stand against an illegitimate and criminal government. It took me many years to understand how my father manifested his opposition, and most of all, why he did it in the way he chose to. He had found satisfaction and a sense of usefulness in writing opinion pieces of a reflective and philosophical bent for the weekly graphic magazine. He had taught the history of philosophy and the philosophy of history at the USD graduate school. Now, back home, with the graphic shut down and every existing venue for publication subject to official censorship, he could not write. And the schools were riddled with military spies, so he could not teach. Formerly very active in social circles, he found himself faced with the dilemma of meeting many old friends who had formerly denounced Marcos but who were now singing the praises of the dictatorship. He was even more disgusted with seeing many people he had been close to because of their closeness to his family, because of his father, and who were now active and prominent supporters of the new society. And there were others whom it seemed were fence-sitting or pretending to be in opposition when they were actually secret admirers of Marcos. His decision was a personally painful one, but one which only someone with his pride could reach and adhere to. He cut off friendships left and right, based on whether they supported the dictatorship or held office due to his good graces. At the same time, he refrained from socializing with people whom he felt were being watched by the dictatorship or who were too indiscreet in their opposition. The end result was that he ended up living the life of a recluse, and having retreated into this sort of life, he was known as an eccentric recluse until the end of his life. Growing up, I could neither see nor appreciate the moral distinctions that dictated my father's behavior. All I knew was that my father was bitterly against the government, but would do nothing about it except to warn me never to repeat what I heard to anyone who was not close to the family, and even then, never, ever on the phone. I would come home from school and hand him PTA announcements, which he would rip into shreds because everything is now headed by those puñetero colonels. A lot of expletives were aimed at Marcos and his lackeys, but in public, he would say nothing. In the meantime, my father's sister was marching around on the streets, was arrested at one point, and being very, very brave in my eyes. And here was my father saying a lot but doing nothing. We went to bookstores a lot. My father made futile attempts to get me interested in sports. But aside from these bonding moments, he did nothing political. He did not vote in any referendums or so-called presidential elections under Marcos, and yet, during the famous noise barrage of 1978, he didn't even ring a little bell in the manner of Luis Araneta. Instead, he worried that some ruffian might scratch his car. Finally came the government decree that people could travel without having to secure permission, and we traveled as much as possible. At one point, there was a chaotic and ill-fated attempt to emigrate to Australia. Then the decision to send me to school in America so that, as he put it, you will know what it is like to live in a free country. A vivid memory from this time was the assassination of Ninoy Aquino, frantic calls to Manila interspersed with puzzled queries directed at my father, who on earth is Ninoy Aquino? A later memory was being required to watch the Democratic Convention on TV, so you can see democracy at work. And during our visits home, a puzzling and increasingly frustrating resolve on his part not to say anything to anyone about what he felt about the dictatorship. In 1985, as the campaign was heating up for the snap elections, I had to endure what I felt was the greatest humiliation of my life. At one of the few parties my father attended, the guests enthusiastically sang Bayan Ko, and my father refused to stand with the rest and sing. He forced me to do the same. What kind of hypocrisy is this? I asked myself, and being all of 15, this only served to reinforce my teenage rebelliousness. Only much later did I learn the reason for his refusing to stand when people sang the anthem of the opposition. First, that it went against his rule not to make any public manifestations of opposition, and second, because he was not about to join in community singing with what he considered a bunch of Johnny-come-latelys as far as opposition to the dictatorship was concerned. He blamed many of these people for the very existence of the dictatorship because they had been all for it so long as it had not affected their pocketbooks. In the end, and it was a confusing but, as they say, cathartic experience for me, I came to understand why, of the two children of Manuel L. Quezon, himself accused of being a dictator in his time, one chose to manifest her irreconcilable opposition to the dictatorship in public, while one chose to show his resistance in seemingly useless, if not extremely intellectually convoluted, manners. It was, perhaps, most of all, a reflection of their personalities and character. My father was proud. He could be extremely arrogant, and his reaction was to look down his nose at everyone who had anything to do with Marcos. But he also knew himself to be weak physically and was plagued by that all too prevalent ailment of good Catholics, scruples. How to hate the sin and love the sinner if you are proud and even a snob? Better to hide among your books and have nothing to do with either the sinner or the sinful government. My father's sister, on the other hand, a far more optimistic and positively determined person, vowed to both outlast the dictatorship and do her part to expose its abuses. I like to think my father actually suffered more, not only because of the self-inflicted agony that comes from hating a despot and yet refusing to make a public stand against him, but also because of the alienation, the isolation, the bitterness that filled his mind and heart. It was a resistance that, in retrospect, I believe, took moral courage. But it was a form of resistance that few understood, and which I only understood fully when my father was already dead. I never had the chance to tell him that I was proud of him, and ashamed of not having understood what he gave up for me and for the country. But every year, on September 18th, his death anniversary, I remind myself to be thankful. You've been listening to the Manolo Quezon is the Explainer podcast. You can catch us on Anchor, on Spotify, on Apple, and other places where you can find fine podcasts. Thanks for listening.